When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Is it even possible to get, you know, like an affordable home these days? Like, it probably won't be anytime soon, but I would like to get there.
Hi, and thank you for tuning in to today's episode. I wanted to just remind you that today is the second part of my conversation with Cameron. And so if you haven't already, please check out part one, which aired on Friday, July 12th. Today, Friday, July 19th, will be the second part of my conversation. And as always, if you like the podcast, we would super appreciate it if you could subscribe and also share it with a friend. I hope you enjoy today's episode.
If you pass the test, that doesn't mean you're CFP. You still have the years afterwards that you have to accrue hours and all of that. So I don't want to make that decision lightly if I make it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So what I will say is a little pivot with career here, but I think that personal finance is a great space. I definitely think that we need more diversity in the space. It's predominantly, I think it's like 80% older males.
Sounds like my field.
So you just have, yeah, I'm sure probably is very similar.
I feel right at home.
Yeah, you'll feel right. I know. I worked on Wall Street. So it was like, oh, older guys, like, perfect. That's what I'm used to. No, women, wonderful. So I think we need more diversity in that. Also, the CPA is a wonderful exam, I think, a wonderful credential. It's often you see people get the CPA and then go work for a big accounting firm. There's not a ton, and I think this is a huge opportunity. There are not a lot of young people that are going into tax returns, right? Like to run a tax practice. Right. And there's a lot of those that are going to be for sale. They're right now, what I'm seeing in a very small marketplace is I'm seeing big companies do roll ups. So they're just buying all the smaller shops that are like two to four CPAs. And that's a very
like
lucrative business.
Equity thing or? Sort of
More like smaller to mid-sized businesses buying the smaller business. So like let's say we had five small CPA firms, like two to three people. I hate to say it, but guys,
finance bros.
Dudes. Yeah. And they're older, they want to retire, you know, they don't want to work as much. And so like one conglomerate will come in, and this is like a regional firm, not even a national firm will come in. Okay. Like in our area, one firm came in and bought, I think, all five of them, every single one.
Okay. Wow.
So now your option to get your tax return is like that company or the one person who hasn't retired, you know, like the one person who like didn't sell and hasn't retired. So I think that's a huge opportunity if you like tax. I also think it's an interesting lifestyle because you will be very busy and probably work 7 days a week from probably January, February through tax filing. If you do businesses, you'll have returns through September. If you don't do businesses, you could probably finish up if you just do personal returns. Some people will do extensions. You kind of have like a busy 6 months and probably like a pretty chill 6 months, depending on how you structure your business.
Six months.
I think it's a really interesting business model. Can be quite lucrative if you're willing to have like an ebb and flow. I kind of like the idea personally. I'm not a consistent good worker. Like I have times where I'm really productive, times where I'm not as productive. So I've always worked my schedule that way.
Yeah.
So I think it could be a very attractive lifestyle. You could build a very big business. Also, if you own the business, you're in control of like, how many clients do you take? How big do you make it? How small, you know, like you have a lot of control. So I really always encourage young people, if you like personal finance and you like accounting is a different animal, but if you like that, I think that's a very interesting career path. And I think there's a ton of opportunity if you look at the landscape and the average age of a CPA doing personal tax returns. I think there's a huge opportunity to buy a business and probably get a deal because there's not going to be enough buyers. And if you have a good work ethic and are willing to put in the hours that are necessary for, because you can't tell somebody like, oh, I'm not working today because there's a deadline, right? The government has implemented a deadline. So you have to work around that deadline.
Absolutely.
I also obviously really like the CFP. That's what I have. That's what I did. I don't like tax returns. I want nothing to do with that.
See, I have a feeling like I could do them if I, like, you know, I have the aptitude, I could do the training, but yeah, I think I want to work with people. I enjoy that aspect of it a lot. And I agree, like the diversity aspect, it's just so cool to know, like, okay, if I entered this field, I'd be one more woman, like solidarity.
Yeah. And there's not, you know, the average age, right? So when I started, it got into this field, it was just about to turn 29, which for Wall Street felt very old because high burnout rate.
Absolutely.
But for personal finance, I was like so young, you know, I was like, oh, this is fun. Cause I felt old on the trading floor. Cause the interns were like 22 and I was 29. So I was like old. And then I go to this field and they're like, oh, are you like with your dad? And I'm like, no, I own the business. What are you doing with my parent? Or like, are you an assistant? And I was like, no. Skews higher for age-wise, which you can take two ways, right? I always like to take the positive spin on things. Like you can either say, oh, that's not going to be as fun because I'm not going to have as many, I'm going to go to conferences and I'm not going to have anyone to hang out with or, you know, right? Or you could look at it on the flip side and say, well, that's obviously an opportunity because I'm different, right? Because
I was going to say,
traditional.
I will say, even being part of a smaller business who is definitely, you know, more conservative leaning and like, I don't necessarily align with their ideals in that way. I have simply come in with a teachable spirit. Like that is something that my parents instilled in me. And I think older people, you know, even if they look at you and have an opinion of you based on how you look, how you, as soon as you open your mouth, and you show them, hey, I'm here, I want to learn, I'm ready to learn, they will take you under their wing because they know, oh, I'm old and I want this field to flourish, you know, like simply put.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah. And it's
the right people.
They've done this, the right people. Yeah. And they've done the studies, like there's just not enough, the big banks have done that. There's just not enough young people coming into the accounting field and the personal finance field. There's just not enough young people. I don't know why. I think it's a great field. What I will say that I've seen is it takes a bit to ramp, right? Like, so there is a foundation that you need to build. And that sometimes
and
is
getting
not,
that client base.
Yeah. And also your skill set, right? And so I think what I've seen a lot owning a business is people come in and they want to be in the role where they're working with somebody who has $1 million. That's great. The person with $1 million doesn't want to work with you, right? Until you have a certain skill set.
The credentials.
It's a mismatch. Yeah, you have to have the credentials and a bit of the experience of like, how do you handle certain scenarios, right? How do you advise on certain scenarios if you haven't done one yet, right? You just, and they know, they people can sniff out if you've had the reps or not, right? If you know how to handle an issue with a trust or an estate issue, right? And so I always like to be very aggressive. And what I found, which is in certain roles, there isn't that, you don't have as much of a build for foundation and skills, right? Like, so for instance, on Wall Street, they just throw you right in. You either make it or you don't, right?
Figure it out.
Really, yeah, you'll figure it out. You're either going to be fired or you won't be fired. And we'll find out quarterly whether you're here or you're not here. So it is what it is. And they don't worry about like whether you have the skills or not. They're, like you're either going to survive and bring on clients or you're going to get fired at the end of the quarter. So super easy. It's not the same animal when you're dealing with personal finance because there's that relationship aspect that needs to be there. And so I think it's just a longer runway to get to where you want to go. I think you can expedite it in certain ways, but I think that, and I hate saying this because this wouldn't have been attractive if someone told me this. I don't listen. So I was like, well, I can do it in 2 years. And people were like, no, you can't. I'm like, okay, I'm going to do it in 2 years. I just think it takes a little bit of time to get the skill set because there's so many things that are thrown at you when you're dealing with people and dealing with people's money. Like every week I see new scenarios, which I would have never guessed 11 years later.
No. And the emotional aspect, people get emotional about their money. And if something goes wrong in their eyes, right? Even I imagine like on the investment side of things, if they like open their portfolio and they're like, why do I have $20,000 less dollars? Like people, when they aren't thinking in that way and they just kind of want to hand it over and be like, make me more money. You know, that part does feel a little bit scary. I'm not saying I wouldn't be up to the challenge, but
Yeah, that's so what I will say, what I find specifically for women, I don't know for men, but I find for women is usually the reason women don't like the field or have told me they don't not interested is because of the investment component. Now the investment component, yeah, just because of exactly what you said. And I do think that women tend to be a bit more empathetic just as a gender. Right. And so I think we care a bit more than maybe the men in a different way, that it's,
you don't want to let people down more. It's ingrained in us. It's a guilt. Societal yes. thing. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. I would feel bad. Now, interestingly enough, my assistant, she said she talked to an advisor who's like successful. And she's like, oh, well, like, what do you think? The market might be going down. We might have a recession. And he's like, I don't worry about it. If it goes up, it goes down. I don't think about it.
That's the nature.
And I was like, how do you, that's the nature, right? Like, I actually worry. Like, what if your account goes, like, I know it might go down, but I actually stress about that. And so, like, I just think
that there's a difference between hearing that and understanding mm-hmm. that. Like, and most people, they will not let themselves understand that. And that's your job, is to try to make them understand that.
Yep. So it's an interesting dynamic, but I think that women bring a great alternative. I think that men are phenomenal advisors and you can have a great advisor. I think it just brings a little bit, it depends on what you want, who you want to work with, right? And so I think women have a different spin on it. And I do think that sometimes women are more intimidated by the career because of the investment component. And I will say that that was one that intimidated me. It's one thing to have an institutional client not make money. It's another thing to have somebody not make money and change their retirement date, right? To tell somebody like, okay, yeah, you can't retire.
That's the
this
personal
July.
Component.
Yes. And I feel like there's more of an ownership there because you see the impact. And so I will say, though, even though that part's intimidating, there's very good ways of overcoming that and making sure that you can handle it and feel comfortable with it. But I do think it's a great career trajectory. I don't think we have enough young people. We don't have enough women. We don't have enough diversity in general. I think that as long as you're willing to give yourself a longer runway than some other roles, it's not an immediate overnight success. It just can't be with the relationship aspect. And with, if you're going to be handling people's money, you have to have a very good skill set in a lot of areas of personal finance, of not course. Just investments. Yeah. And so like learning that whole, all the components is, as you pointed out, the great thing about the CFP is once you pass the exam, which is very difficult, you are not eligible to use the designation until you have the work experience, because that work experience is just so valuable in attaining the skill set. That
yeah,
practical
and I mean,
knowledge.
To kind of branch over to the industry I'm in, I had to take 15 tests to get my license. 15. And it's different. It's not the same for everyone because there's so many ways to get into this field. If you're ex-military, if you went the apprenticeship route, but in the same way that as a CFP, you have to accrue those hours, I couldn't just test for this. I had to do my route that I chose was 24 months of schooling and learning how to, starting from the basics and what hardware is and how it's named, all the way up to removing and overhauling engines, you know? And so that, and now I'm learning, I'm always learning in this field because now I'm in my job. Now I'm actually, I have to learn how to be responsible for these planes. They take off. They don't just sit in the hangar at school. They take off. That's terrifying when I think about it a little bit too much. But I haven't gotten into too much trouble yet, so I think I will be okay.
Yeah, but it's similar in that like there's a lot of ownership. Like, so if someone comes in your office and you make a recommendation, like you have to be comfortable that you made the right recommendation, right? With the same, I would actually think there's, the plane thing would make me more nervous, but it's all relative.
Right.
You know?
So if I'd
be like, well,
this,
I hope I really like wrench that on properly and everything's going to stay attached. Yep.
Because sometimes you wrench something on and there's like another component that's in the way and you're like, well, I sure hope it'll stay.
It stays together.
But it's in the sky because you can pull your car over on the side of the road, but you sure cannot pull over onto a cloud. So
no, yeah, there is no emergency pullover up in the sky. Nope. So yeah, I would say from a risk and liability standpoint, it's similar, right? So like you make a recommendation that's wrong or a mistake, you have liability risk, just like you probably would with that. So I do think there is a lot of similarities from the fact that there's a lot of testing time invested classroom, and then the hours you have to have, the practical knowledge. And then there is risk and liability involved. And also when the federal government is involved, we have a lot of paperwork and compliance oversight. And that, well, I will also say, is something that I get a lot, when I hire people, I get a lot of pushback. They're like, a lot of paperwork. And I'm like, it's the federal government. It's not me. I didn't create any of these forms.
Same for our side as well. In my industry, we are directly liable to the FAA. And that is the Federal Aviation Administration. In the same way, we have airworthiness directives, service bulletins, like all, I could name 10 different things, right, that we have to. And I will say this, actually enjoy the paperwork and the reading through it and that kind of stuff. So that's, for me, honestly, a green flag in terms of it being translatable over to something like a CFP.
Yeah, that is one thing that I think isn't talked about enough. There are a lot of rules and regulations. They change on a regular basis. As you know, like, everyone knows, like, okay, the Roth IRA, traditional IRA contribution changes, right? But so do all the rules, like most of the estate planning rules change, tax changes, retirement laws change, right? Every year, it feels like, at least in the last few years, you've had like some massive regulation overhauls. And so it generates new paperwork and distribution rules and contribution rules, right? So everything changes. And you're in a highly regulated industry with the, you know, FAA. And so is personal finance. It's highly regulated. And so,
yes.
Yeah, these are, I think everything, every career path has a pro and con list, right? Like, I don't know that anyone's ever been like, my job's perfect. I love 100% of it every day.
Like, if they say that, they're probably lying.
I just don't think that's a real, you know, realistic part. You know, there's like a lot of parts of being an adult that are wonderful. And there's a lot of parts about being adult that is not so fun, but you know, it is what it is. And so I think the CFP path poses a lot of really great opportunities, as long as you're aware of the things that go into it, which the way I look at it is like, you're most like, in certain industries, you're just going to be in a regulated industry, right? And I don't, that's just part of the job.
If you embrace it, you know, if you embrace it and understand its value and the ethical component and, you know, all of those things, like it's less scary. It becomes less of a monster and more of a friend, I think.
Yeah. And I think you just choose what works for you, right? So like Wall Street was less regulated. I did a lot less paperwork because you're dealing with institutional clients. So the regulation isn't as, you know, they assume everyone knows what they're doing. And when it comes to retail, which is personal finance, like individuals, small businesses and so forth, there's a lot more oversight. So, but you know, working on Wall Street on a trading floor is a very different work environment, right? So that's, I would probably say, is a con. There's less paperwork, which is a pro. So you just, you know, you choose what works for you. But I do think, I 100% believe it's a great career path. I think it's very challenging to get into, stick with the education, get the hours. But I think if you're willing to commit to it, I think it's a phenomenal career path.
Right. So I was just going to ask, you know, there's obviously two routes I could go about. And that is, you know, keep my full-time job. Financially, I would have to, right? Like, I couldn't just not work.
Yeah, because you've good income. Yeah.
Yes, I do. And so that's obviously a factor that I've like thought a lot about, is I don't know if I could make 60K right out the gate, you know, like even if I took the test and was trying to get experience, you know, after school, obviously, like I'd need to get a bachelor's. But I have a lot of credit, so I could probably, if I was pretty aggressive about that, do that in, you know, 2 years. But then there's that whole, like, this is kind of where my mind goes. It's like, there's that whole other fact of like, okay, I'll either have to put a lot of my own money to, I would have to put a lot of my own money towards it, and probably have to take on student debt if I did it in an accelerated fashion. And, you know, so there's that aspect that's like, okay, do I want to do that, you know, right after I've paid off all of my debt? And so these are definitely just, this is the personal finance aspect here of my own finance. It's like, do I want to take this on? And then it possibly doesn't even work out. But like you said earlier, I think your 20s are really the time to do this, as long as you are kind of keeping everything else in line that sets you up for success in the future regardless. But yeah, I appreciate your insight a lot.
Yeah, I think that one other way you could do it is if you found a wealth management firm, where you're located, I'm not off the top of my head, but if you found like a wealth management firm where they were looking to hire, and you would go hire in at whatever role, you know, an admin role, right? Or office role. And then with the path of you start working in the office, seeing how things are run, and then you work your way up to while working, so you have a job, that you start studying for your, well, you'd go to the undergraduate program, right? That would do, you'd have credits towards it, and you would do the one that you come out and you have your prereqs done for the CFP, which is great. Yeah. And then study and sit for your CFP. But if you found a firm that would hire you with that trajectory, right? That would be another way to do it.
Yeah, because you can definitely set yourself up, I think, in that way as like an asset. And I've done some research on, you know, like power planning and that kind of side of things, and it being sort of an in into the industry. But I think if like, if you had any knowledge on that, that in terms of like how doable it is, you know, at what level of education can you do something like that?
So I think that you can go into a firm, depends on what the firm's rules are. The smaller businesses will be more flexible. I would say what I've often heard from business owners in this recent environment is challenging for hiring, right? And so the fact that you're interested in the career, you'd show up on time, you know, some of those basic things are actually
the basics.
Yeah, it is actually harder to find than you think. Like, significantly
Someone said something. It was like, if you show up on time and do your job, you are already ahead of 90% of people. Like, and if you think about how many people you know that, I mean, I have a coworker that shows up like 30 minutes late from lunch or in the morning, like every single day. No ramifications, but they just accept that because they are so in need of mechanics, you know? But that doesn't favor well for him.
No, but, you know, at this, if it's, it's a challenging hiring environment at the moment. And so it has been. So I'm sure the owner is like, well, that's not ideal, but it's better than someone who doesn't show up every Monday, which I've seen.
We have to say. Yeah.
As you settle a little, it's like, well, they're here most of the day. So not, you know, probably won't get promoted or get a raise, but better than someone who calls out every Monday, which I dealt with, you know, 8 Mondays in a row.
Yikes.
So you only stick on Mondays. So yes, I think showing up on time. I know, ironic. Showing up on time, being willing, being teachable, willing to learn, wanting to learn. I think a lot of those go a very far way. As you said, it's more than probably 90%. I've seen a statistic similar. Like, if you can do these basic things, you're ahead of the majority. If I were in your shoes with wanting to stay where you are, I don't know if there's any big firms there. Like, I don't know that there's like a Fidelity campus or a Vanguard campus, right?
Yeah.
But you could go and look for the small
shops.
Fidelity
campus. I think.
Oh, is there?
Yeah, downtown Greenville. I always walk past it when I'm going to the beautiful park they have there. There is a Fidelity. And
they have training programs, the big firms. Yes. Oh. So you could look for a training program. They're very structured, which I think is great.
Yes.
You start off with the less glamorous jobs, but like, you know, I started off in the call center at Bloomberg. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. Learned a lot fast. They're really great foundational programs at the big firms that they offer training programs. So if there is a bit that, you know, if Fidelity is there or another big firm is there and they have a training program, I think that would be worthwhile looking at to see what they offer.
Yeah.
And what it looks like. And you're usually paid in the training programs.
Accepting less. Yeah, that's awesome. Because in terms of, you know, if I would accept a job that had a lower salary, you know, if I could offset it by having my tuition paid for or doing a training program that would leave me, you know, like
licensing.
Yeah, that's awesome. When I was really, really like desperate and didn't feel like being in my field anymore for, you know, a mixture of reasons, I was like, okay, I could do a banking position at Chase and maybe make like $20 an hour and get, you know, $5,000 of tuition reimbursement. And it still didn't work out to be worth it in my mind. But yeah, I think, you know, even if it's not something that I start tomorrow, I feel like after I get my petty debts paid off, you know, and maybe save a bit for my wedding and increase my emergency savings, like I think I would be in the position to flex a little bit more, which I can kind of figure out like when I'm ready to do that.
Taking care of your health isn't always easy, but it should at least be simple. That's why for the last 3 years, I've been drinking AG1 every day with no exceptions. It's just one scoop mixed in water once a day, every day, and it makes me feel ready to take on my day. That's because each serving of AG1 delivers my daily dose of vitamins, minerals, pre and probiotics, and more. It's a powerful, healthy habit that's also powerfully simple. With AG1, I know I'm getting essential brain, gut, and immune health support with vitamins, probiotics, and nutrients from Whole Foods. I like to think of it as my nutritional insurance. I know I'm covering my nutritional bases from the very start of the day. If there's one product I had to recommend to elevate your health, it's AG1, and that's why I've partnered with them for so long. So if you want to take ownership of your health, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase exclusively at drinkag1.com/futurerich. That's drinkag1.com/futurerich. Check it out. Yeah, and you don't have to do it now. As you said, you could, you know, enjoy the nice salary you have and investigate, like look around in, you know, South Carolina and like, what are the big firms? What do those training programs look like? Do you have a friend of a friend who might know someone who's in one, right? Are there small wealth management firms around? Do you have any connections to anyone there? Or should you just cold call and say, I just wanted to know like what your hiring process looks like? You can do a lot of investigation over the next year to 2 years and then see if it makes sense at that point. Maybe then you're ready to move into a different career path, but you could do some of the like investigating now.
And I mean, just as an example, like one of the perks of donating to, they have a young professionals group that has a ton of people in finance, and they do the mixes, the like quarterly, mixes. And so I've gotten a business card of a great guy who runs a sort of, he doesn't run it, but he works at a new like credit union that they really care about that personal interaction, all of that. One of my dad's best friends, he's a financial advisor for Edward Jones in Colombia. And, you know, like I have these, I've already reached out to him and I'm planning on, you know, chatting with him maybe when I'm more ready.
These are all great opportunities. Yeah. Lots of options. And I think that if you know you're interested in personal finance, you can start to have those conversations, see what it takes and kind of figure out what the right path in. But as you said, like I would get your debts paid down, increase your emergency fund, plan for the wedding and enjoy yourself. I mean, you could do it at 25 or 26, you know, and still have a huge career.
Yeah.
Well, very good. So do you have any other questions for me?
I think for right now, that answered most of my questions. One kind of outlier random question.
Sure.
As someone who belongs to Gen Z, I get really worried about buying a home. I am constantly looking, you know, at Zillow listings, and I'm lucky. Again, I still technically live in a lower standard of living area compared to somewhere like Los Angeles or, you know, like even those bigger suburbs in California, Texas, all these places. But it is something that my partner and I have chatted about, and I think we would like to own a home. You know, I had to move into this duplex very quickly, and we had so many issues with it. Like I didn't have a toilet for like a week, like all this crazy stuff that's feels illegal. Like up until recently, like my AC couldn't hold lower than 80 degrees. And in the South, that's just like the humidity and everything. It just makes it feels unlivable. And it turns out that like the contractors literally didn't install insulation in the attic when they were renovating the place, which like, are you joking? And I had to fight with my rental property or agency to get them to come install insulation. You know, like those kinds of things. I'm like, yes, at least I didn't have to pay for those things. But with owning a home, if you make an educated, you know, purchase and you get the inspections done and you buy from someone reputable or ethical, like, you don't have to deal with all of that stuff up front, you know? So I guess my question is just kind of, is it even possible to get, you know, like an affordable home these days? Like, it probably won't be anytime soon, but I would like to get there.
Yeah, I think it's a great goal. I do think I'm curious to see what happens with the housing market. I do think the prices have gotten a bit elevated, and we haven't really had a big downturn on home prices in a while, right? Mm-hmm. So 2008 probably was the last time. Yeah. So we've gone quite a long time with just appreciating. So what you can do, I mean, so the hard part, this is like in the 20s, there's like a lot going on. So like wedding, house. Yeah, it's like we got all the things. So I think that you could be more creative with the wedding cost and maybe cut that down a little with the goal of having money for a down payment. Absolutely, you do live in a cost of living, but I do think there's, like we talked about, there's trade-offs. I think we did a podcast with my sister called like Wedding or Windows. Because
stop, that's so funny.
Yeah, I think that the podcast title was wedding or windows, because the quote for the windows, they bought a house. Yeah, you should listen to that one. The quote for the windows was insane, but they felt like they really needed the windows, and I was like, well, you can't really have a big wedding and also get windows for your house. Like, we need to choose. So they had a smaller 30-person, like, last minute. I was, like, supposed to go to another friend's wedding. I had already committed. And he was like, wait, what do you mean you're not coming? I was like, well, my sister just told me she's getting married now.
It's my sister. What do you mean?
He was, like, really upset. He was like, you just tell her you already RSVP'd to my wedding. And I was like, I don't know what to do. We should sign it to do windows and have a very small wedding now in, like, 3 months. Like, you know, it was, that's like, awesome. Very fast. So I think that buying a home is great. There are pros and cons, like everything. Houses are expensive. There are always going to be things that come up. Nothing in a home generally is $100 ever.
No, absolutely not.
There's always big ticket items.
Yeah, that's another aspect where I'm like, okay, it's one thing to get a down payment, but I don't want to buy a house unless I have like $5,000 to $10,000 at least. Yes. Yeah. Like in an emergency saving, that pretty much would just be for housing emergencies, because Murphy's Law, feel like you move into a house and it's like you need a new roof or your foundation is cracked.
Or your air conditioner has a leak in it like ours does. And that's $2,000. I was like, I'm not doing it. We're going to add some Freon to that sucker and we're going to call it a day.
Keep it pumping.
I don't care. Keep it pumping. I don't care if it leaks. The leak is like, I'd rather lose a little bit of Freon than spend the amount of money on the
patch it
fix.
Up. Yeah.
Yeah. The fix for air conditioner is $2,000. The Freon was $240. So I can add Freon to this thing every other year. It's totally no brainer. Anyway, so nothing's $100 expense. Even the Freon wasn't $100. Mm-hmm. So, but I do think that now when you're in, we have the wedding, your wedding, other weddings, you just have to say, okay, like, what is our priority? What will make us the happiest? And so, like, for you and your partner, maybe it's like, we want to have a wedding and we want to spend X. Or maybe you say, we want to have a much smaller wedding. We're going to cut the budget back on that because we really want to work towards a down payment and a higher emergency fund, so that at 28 or 29, we can purchase something. So I definitely think it's attainable. I think you live in an area where it's really attainable. Like, if you were in LA, I'd say,
good
rent.
I know, like, I'm lucky. Again, my rent is so, so low. Like, I'm paying we're paying $1,178 a month. Like, that it's a two bed, you know, it's small, but like, we even have, like, where I'm filming or recording right now, like, I'm able to make a little music studio, you know, and it's our creative room. So I don't know that I would have that, you know, living somewhere like New York or Chicago and all that. So I'm definitely thankful for it. But, you know, we would eventually, especially having a dog, like, we'd like a fenced in backyard and like all these kinds of things that would kind of be life changing, you know, in a day to day way.
So here's my advice. What I would do is, I personally think doing a smaller, less costly wedding and saving more for down payment is a good trade off, personally.
Okay. Yeah, but I agree. It's personal. That's the route.
I think that's a better route. And here's what I'll say. Start saving for the down payment. Like, so if we like siphon off some of the money from the wedding, and some of it's down payment, some of it's wedding. Mm-hmm. And then you're in a position, you can always, right? I like optionality. You could say, you know what? We looked at the houses. They're too expensive. We'd rather just keep paying rent, but we're going to keep saving for the down payment. So if an opportunity comes up for a property that we like, that's within our budget, we're ready to jump on that because you save the money. So there's nothing wrong with renting, especially when you have low rent. And you'll even hear a lot of like bigger social media stars, like Lewis Howes, I'm pretty sure is a renter. He's never bought.
Wow.
So it's about the optionality, right? So having the ability to buy a house and choosing not to is a very different situation than being priced out of that. So there's nothing wrong in your 20s saying like, we're saving for the down payment. We're not ready to make that commitment because it's going to change our lifestyle, right? If there's a huge rainstorm the weekend we want to go away and our basement is flooding, well, we're probably not going to leave, right? That'd be irresponsible because of the cost of the damage. So there is something really nice about the flexibility of renting. There are annoying parts for sure, like as you talked about.
No, but there's also the nice part of like,
you can just take a vacation and of like, your apartment floods, that sucks. You have renter's insurance, hopefully.
Yeah.
And then you call the landlord and it's their cost, right? So. Right. I would just start saving for it, knowing that you want to make sure that it's an option in the future. Whether or not you take the option will depend on where your life is.
Yeah.
And what and your situation
with
is.
With something like the down payment, I have seen so many like mixed opinions about taking advantage of first time buyer loans and putting zero down. It, like, what is your general, do you have a general like hard and fast rule?
For, I do
like,
not. 10%, yes. I do not like,
you know, 20.
Yes. I do not like zero. Do not do zero. Either. Personal
that
opinion
like
is if you can't save any money for the debt, like unless you're doing zero down because you're keeping like $100,000 in cash because you don't want to put anything towards it. That's a different scenario. But generally speaking, if you can't save the money that you need to put something down, you're, in my opinion, not in the position to buy a home.
No.
Because if you weren't able to save $1,000 or, you know, 5% to put 5% down, you're not going to be financially prepared when there's a problem, and there guaranteed will be a problem.
Because exactly, if you don't even have money for the down payment, what's going to happen when there is that leak, that foundation crack, that, you know, X, Y, and Z. So I agree 100%.
Or your air conditioner breaks when it's 110 degrees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, that's coming up soon here in South Carolina next week.
Yeah,
actually, so it's like, going up to like 105.
Yeah, and so now your air conditioner broke. What are we going to, what's the plan? Or your basement floods. What's the plan? Yeah. You're going to live with black mold? No, you have to, so it goes on a credit card is usually what happens.
Mm. Oh God.
And then it starts to get
averse to that.
Well, that's
now.
What happened. It gets out of control. Because it's not a luxury expense. You're not putting a vacation on it. It's like our basement flooded to remediate
it's
this. So especially in human
like,
areas.
It's horrible.
Yeah. So I believe in putting something down. I don't think it has to be a hard, fast 20, depending on what you have in emergency funding.
Okay.
But I think that before you buy a house, you need to be in a financial position to do it, including the money down, the closing costs, depending on state, can be quite high, and the emergency fund. You need to be financially prepared for the decision. I think it's a big decision. And I'm not a believer that you have to own a house. I think you need to put yourself in a position that you don't get priced out of where you want to be, whether that's renting or not, renting or buying. I think that if renting allows you to accrue a much larger net worth, then that's probably your best option versus being house poor and that's you're riding on a house sale for your net worth. I don't believe in that.
No, I don't. That's about what I was expecting.
I don't have a hard and fast rule, but I'm of the standpoint of owning a home is not the all end all be it, right?
It'll like you don't that's have a very to own a boomer home. Mentality.
Yeah. You don't have to own a home to be financially successful. You don't.
Agreed.
If it makes financial sense to own a home, right? You're cutting costs, building equity, and in a financial position to take on that, then that makes sense. Right now with where your rent is, probably you would spend more on a home. Will the home appreciate more than like the money you would put in the market? Depends. We don't know.
Yeah. Because it is like rent, you know, month to month, I'm paying this for rent. But in the same way that when you put money in investments, you don't know what's going to be on the other end. You don't know if you're going to retire in a market downturn. You don't know, you know, like it's the same way for a house, because what if there's this great job that like you absolutely do not want to turn down three states away, but the housing economy
house doesn't
just
sell.
Garbage.
Yeah. Yeah. You're stuck. I've seen that happen. I had a girlfriend, she bought a house, great neighborhood, right? Was very competitive to get the house, got the house. Husband got a job in Florida at a rental property in Georgia. Right? Everything was going swimmingly. So now they bought the house in Florida, have the rental property in Georgia, have the house. It was another Northeast state. Right. House in the Northeast state was expensive, but was super competitive to get it. Great school district, great house, blah, blah. We'll sell, you know, we'll sell in a week. Didn't sell for a year. Didn't sell for a year. Had to sell the rental property because they're losing bleeding money on the house in the Northeast. Oh, bleeding.
Wow. Yeah,
not ideal. I mean, so like you only hear
change your life.
Yeah. It's also really stressful in a relationship.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not a fun conversation every night to be like, oh, we're bleeding. You know, the tenants fell through. They couldn't get tenants. It was like really bad. And so I think that unfortunately with social media, it's like the highlight reel. And I think it's the same thing with real estate. All you hear is how amazing real estate is. You do no work and make a ton of money. I don't think that exists. I really don't think you're showing the full picture, because there's a lot of ways it can go sideways. As much as it can go up, it can be a really hard path as well. And so
you got to be careful of Instagram and TikTok and the easy money. I mean, anytime someone says, oh, it's easy to make money doing this, run far, far away, I feel.
Yeah, that's what I think. And so I think that you really always need to let the numbers drive the decision. And so if you guys found a home that you really liked and you was like a little bit larger than where you are now with an outdoor space, and then the mortgage numbers come in comparable, then maybe that makes sense. And you're willing to take on the responsibility of a home ownership. You're ready for that, which is a personal decision. I think that's great. If not, just keep saving. You'll be in So
the worst that happens is if you decide, you know, like, okay, we're going to rent for the next 5 years, that money can, you know, or even, hey, you know what, for the next decade, we want the flexibility to travel X, Y, and Z, throw that money in investments and let it grow even more, you know? And I like, as long as you've got that long-term, you know, sort of mindset, because I know people get in trouble when they're like, oh, I'll just invest my down payment, and then they get ready for a house and it's like, oh, my down payment's 50% of what I put in. Oops.
Or like on the flip side, if you think really long term, like you never buy, you always live hand to mouth, right? So there's never really a lot for saving. So you're always renting and always hoping rent will be a certain percentage of your income, and you're spending everything else. And then you get into retirement and it's like, wow, now you're priced out of rent, right? It's too expensive. Yeah. Can't retire, haven't saved enough, so no option to ever buy a home. Those are the positions that I think are worth like looking at and being like, I don't want to be in that position. Mm-hmm. But I'll give you another example. I have a gentleman, he has rented his entire life. He's going to rent until he retires. Rent is the most economical situation. And when he retires, he's going to move to a different state, and then he will buy in retirement. It will be his first time owning a home. He might not like it, so we'll see how that goes. But he's in a great financial position. You know, he might not like it, but he's in a great financial position and will have rented his entire life. And, you know, he might say, you know what, I'll just keep renting in retirement. But he has amassed enough of a net worth that it's a decision. Do you want to own? Do you not want to own? But he's in a good position because the renting was the best financial decision he could have made, because home ownership would have taken away from his actual saving, because he would have been paying too many like homeowner fees and maintenance, and the down payment would have been really high. It was a very high cost of living area. So there's a lot of different ways to do it. But I think ultimately you need to have the math make the decision and not get caught up in like, you have to own a home, because you don't. Only if it makes sense should you own one.
Having been in this position, you never want to feel like you are backed into a corner when making a huge financial decision, like where am I going to live or what job am I going to take? It like you want, again, coming back to the autonomy, you want that to be a decision that you made because you wanted to do it, and it was favorable to your financial future.
Yeah, it made sense. And I will say that I've seen people be house poor and it looks really miserable.
Yeah.
Like very miserable.
It's very miserable. Been there. Been there, and it's miserable.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think what I would do is like, you could listen to the Weddings versus Windows episode. I would recommend that.
Okay.
And so I think that you just decide together, like, okay, we were interested in saving for a down payment for a home, bulking up our joint emergency fund, you know, house emergency fund. And then we're going to let that permanent investment drive the wedding. Right. So maybe then we earmark $5,000 for a wedding.
That is really interesting.
You know?
Yeah. Through working through all of my spreadsheets and, you know, thoughts in my brain about this, I never thought about letting them be connected in a sort of ebb and flow kind of way where, okay, we know that, you know, even if like it's something personal, like we know this person who has been renting a house is looking to sell soon and it's in the exact place we want to be. It's in a, you know, again, like exactly what we want. And we have that money towards a down payment and the wedding, you know, it can kind of be like, okay, we're going to do a little 40-person wedding. And I think, again, as women, you always get worried, oh no, like people are going to be offended if I don't invite them. But it's, I keep telling myself, the right people will understand and the wrong people won't. And that's a really quick and easy way to be like,
to differentiate.
Well,
yeah,
exactly. Like you don't actually care about me and my goals. You probably shouldn't be at my wedding in the first place. So.
Right. Yeah. And I think that when you give yourself a little bit more of a budget, you can be really creative and it can be super special. The money doesn't make it special, right? It's like the reflection of you and your partner, right? And so, then you could even say like, maybe we want to buy a house first and have like a backyard wedding. We just want to host people in our home.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different ways you can do both, but I think it comes down to like, you and your partner sitting down and saying like, okay, like what is more of our, like what will make us happier long-term, like a bigger wedding? And that might be a yes. Or is it saving for both, knowing there's an ebb and flow there, right? Depending on situations.
No, it's really funny. Like I never really grew up like imagining my wedding. Like I would get eloped. I would go to a courthouse. I don't really care. But like, it's mostly coming from like, you know, I know that that's something that's really, really important to her. And she, and it's not in a, I don't want to celebrate that kind of way, but like, I don't care to celebrate it. It's that they are just, you know, I would maybe want to be like, okay, I want to spend money on going on a really nice honeymoon, you know, like, that's all stuff that you have to talk through as a couple, because I mean, I think especially that's something that I love about being in a queer relationship. It's like that communication that is like central to our relationship, you know, I wasn't going to say it, but we try to absolutely understand like what is important to each other, like at all times, regardless of what it is, what it has to do with. It's just really, really important that we know like what's on each other's minds and where we're at with different decisions that are kind of hard, you know?
Yeah. And these are hard things, right? So if it's more important to her than you, it's a compromise, right? Of like, let's talk through this and where are we going to allocate our finances? And so, yeah, I think it's a conversation, but I think it should be fluid, right? So it could change, like just because we decide this today, like, as you said, maybe this perfect property comes up and then maybe you could always defer the wedding, right? You can get married and have the celebration. I really think it's good to challenge yourself to think differently. Like that's more common in Europe. That's what I did. We did our celebration after we did our legal ceremony. It is common in Europe to separate the two. And so it can be whatever you want it to be, right? Like what we did was like completely unorthodox.
We're definitely leaning towards the whole smaller wedding, bigger reception at a later time, or, you know, at a more affordable area. Like if we know someone who has a huge backyard, you know, like that is something that we could easily do.
But yeah, I think sit down and talk about like, because as we said, in your 20s, there's a lot of like, where do we want to prioritize and how do we want to divvy up our resources? And I think with the home, it's just important to make sure that I do think it's important to save for it and have it be an option. I don't think it needs to be today, tomorrow, but if you could,
option
I think right now renting
rather
makes
than necessity. Yeah. I like
option.
That.
It's an option. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely not a necessity, not with where your renting costs are at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an optionality.
Awesome.
But yeah, go back and listen to Weddings Versus Windows, because that was, I had to have a little, my sister goes by Natasha on the podcast, and I always very much enjoy her because she's very smart, but personal finance is not taught, obviously. So sometimes we have to have like little check-ins with Natasha about, it's a learned skill. She likes to defer a lot of it to me. So I was like, we're going to have to chat about this. Because you can't afford to do both, you know? We got to choose here, Weddings Versus Windows. Or, house versus, wedding. That's another big choice that people make. And I think that you can compromise. But if you want to go big on both, like, it's hard to do both, right? You have to choose. Yeah, I make a choice. This was super interesting conversation. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Yes, of course. Thank you so much for letting me join. I was very excited when I got your response.
Oh, good. This was lovely. And for all of our listeners, you can follow along. And if you like the show, please subscribe and rate us. And then you can follow us on YouTube, TikTok, and Instagram. Time for our disclaimer. The opinions voiced in this podcast are for general information only and not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. All performance references are historical and do not guarantee future results. Make sure that you consult with your own legal, tax, and/or financial advisor before making any decisions.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.